Thanksgiving is a time to reflect on the blessings we have in life, celebrate with family, and open up a can of Ocean Spray cranberry sauce. And what better place to do that than on The Political Junkie? I'm Ken Rudin. Ahead this hour, we examine the extent of voter suppression in this country.
Between 2014 and 2018, 16 million people were purged from the voter roll list. It is so systematic that it just flies under the radar as routine government operations.
Plus, John Warner reflects back on his 30 years in the Senate, including his controversial not guilty vote in the Clinton impeachment trial.
Mr. Warner, not guilty.
And we look back at Ronald Reagan's trajectory from defeat in 1976 to victory 4 years later.
It was a very, very difficult path. In some ways, even more difficult than 76, because he was taken incoming from the Republican establishment. But in 79, he was taken from a half dozen candidates.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 305 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanksgiving is a special time to give thanks to the people who mean the most to us. It's an opportunity to step back from the daily grind of the political cycle, away from the recriminations and finger-pointing, there's been too much of that, and enjoy some time off with family and loved ones. Of course, we have a lot to be thankful for here at The Political Junkie. We're thankful for you who listen each week on your local station or download the podcast. We're thankful for the many who have donated to keep this program alive. We couldn't exist without you. And we're also thankful to the hundreds of outstanding guests who have joined the show to share their unique insights, irrespective of party or point of view. And so this week, we're reaching back into the archives to revisit some of our favorite interviews from the past. By the way, you'll probably be thankful to hear that you've got an extra week to solve our latest trivia question, which was this. In 2019, Democrats won two of the three gubernatorial elections at stake. When was the last time all three governorships in Louisiana, Kentucky, and Mississippi were won by the same party? If you haven't already, send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll see you next week with a new trivia question and lots of leftover turkey. I know you'll relish that thought.
Singing song, song of the South, sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth.
There's an expression out there, one which we completely agree with, that says, vote as you please, but please vote. The right to vote is one of our most cherished freedoms. But there have been more and more cases of late of states and counties and municipalities that have made it their goal to limit who can vote and to put up as many roadblocks as possible to discourage or impede the ability of citizens to go to the polls. This is happening everywhere, but especially in the South, where African Americans are usually the prime victims of these efforts. Vote suppression in the South is not new, but we're not talking about the 1950s or even the 1960s. We're not talking about James Eastland or Lester Maddox or Bull Connor. We're talking about now. In fact, we've been talking about this for years, at least since 2013, when the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act by allowing states with a history of voting discrimination to change their laws on voting rights. In these past 6 years, we've seen countless examples of efforts made to make it more and more difficult for people who want to use that right. Is it a coincidence that many of these states have Republican governors and legislatures, with many of the laws affecting people of color, people who more often than not vote Democratic? Carol Anderson doesn't think so. She's the chair of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of an infuriating book. I don't think I've ever described a book as infuriating. And it's called One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. We spoke to her last December, shortly after the 2018 midterm elections. I don't know how you were reacting to that intro, but I found my blood boiling at each sentence I said to you because it's infuriating. And, you know, in the old days, when we would talk about voter suppression, we would talk about poll taxes or the white primary or the use of fire hoses and police dogs. That's not what it entails in this day and age.
No, it is. And, you know, when you think about it, we don't see the kind of visual imagery from the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. That's not there any longer. But between 2014 and 2018, 16 million people were purged from the voter roll list in America. From 2016 to 2018, Secretary of State Brian Kemp in Georgia purged 10.6% of voters who were registered. 10.6% of those of registered voters were removed from the rolls. But we don't see the carnage. We don't see the bodies. It is so systematic. It is so bureaucratic that it just flies under the radar as routine government operations.
There was once something called the Voting Rights Act. It passed Congress overwhelmingly in 1965. Then in 2013, there was something called the Shelby decision by the Supreme Court. Can you explain what happened in 65 and explain what changed in 2013?
In 1965, after years and years of agitation and after the explosion on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, what was known as Bloody Sunday, when nonviolent protesters were met with bullwhips and horses and tear gas, and then when one of the protesters who came down later was actually bludgeoned to death, it so horrified the nation that we get the Voting Rights Act. And what the Voting Rights Act did was it said that states that had a history of discrimination against their citizens, particularly based on race, had to get pre-approval by the U.S. Department of Justice before they implemented any of their voting laws, voting regulations, voting requirements, voting restrictions. Anything dealing with the vote had to come through the DOJ before it was implemented. What the Shelby County v. Holder decision did
in 2013
was that the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, gutted that pre-clearance provision in the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court argued, and this was Chief Justice John Roberts in his decision, that the kind of racism that had been operational in the U.S. that led to the Voting Rights Act was no longer a force in American society. And so the Voting Rights Act was archaic. It hadn't changed with the times. America was no longer this kind of racist being that would target its minority populations and try to stop them from voting. By gutting the preclearance provisions, those areas, those jurisdictions, those states that had been under Department of Justice oversight no longer were. And they immediately began to implement laws that targeted their Black and Latino and Asian populations to keep them from the voting box.
I was just going to say, within a short time after the 2013 decision, Southern states with Republican legislatures jumped at the opportunity to make changes in the voting rules, right?
Absolutely. Within 2 hours, for instance, after the ruling, Texas implemented SB 14, and that was their voter ID law. What they used was the lie of massive, rampant voter fraud, and it is a lie. Studies prove that there is not massive, rampant voter fraud. Justin Levitt, a professor out of California, found that from 2000 to 2014, out of 1 billion votes cast, there were 31 cases of voter impersonation fraud. So about 2 a year out of 1 billion votes.
That doesn't really sound like a good reason then to have President Trump and Vice President Pence and Chris Kobach in Kansas put together this voter suppression commission.
Exactly. And one of the things when I talk about it being a fraud, a lie, is that even the massive voter suppressors like Chris Kobach, when he has to go before a federal judge and to prove why his state needs to have all of these voter restriction laws, voter suppression laws, and he yells, well, we've got massive rampant voter fraud. We have all of these non-citizens voting. And he's like, show me. And he can't. Kobach can't. Because it's not there, and he doesn't want to perjure himself in a court of law. And it's the same in Texas. So what they did in Texas with this voter ID law is they said you need to have a government-issued photo ID. But they knew that one-third of the counties in Texas did not have a Department of Motor Vehicles. The NAACP and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund calculated that combined it was about 1.6 million Texans, American citizens, who did not have the required ID to vote. They were overwhelmingly Black, Latino, and poor.
You know, you open your book with a statistic that's often been repeated to me. Between 2012 and 2016, Black voter turnout had dropped by 7%. And the explanation I had always heard was, well, you know, Hillary Clinton was no Barack Obama, or she took the Black vote for granted. And it wasn't just African-Americans. Hispanics failed to show up and Asian voters failed to show up. And it was all because Clinton was, quote, a flawed candidate. But in your book, you make it clear that's not the reason.
The day after the 2016 election, and I'm watching the news and I'm reading the news, and the pundits are all over Hillary as flawed to explain why African Americans just didn't show up. But what they missed was that because of the Shelby County v. Holder decision, this was the first presidential election without the protections of the Voting Rights Act. And what we saw was that in over 30 states, they had implemented voter suppression tactics, voter suppression laws, from voter IDs where they figure out what kinds of IDs African Americans have and don't have and make the ones that African Americans don't have the holy grail to be able to access the ballot box, from moving polling places to purging voter rolls to not fully staffing.
Some voter machines conveniently break down, right? In
exactly. I mean, all of those and gerrymandering, all of that played in to this 7% drop. There's a study that was done in Wisconsin. And remember, Wisconsin was a state that Trump took by a little over 20-some thousand votes. And Scott Walker and the Republican legislature had really fully implemented voter suppression tactics. They had targeted Milwaukee, not only a Democratic stronghold, but a place where 70% of the state's Black population lives. There was a 60,000-vote drop between 2012 and 2016 in Wisconsin. 68% of that drop happened in Milwaukee alone. And a subsequent study found that the voter ID laws in Wisconsin blocked 8% of whites and 27% of African Americans from voting. So when we look at how Trump won, and I put that in quotes, Wisconsin, he won on the back of massive voter suppression.
If the Supreme Court is becoming more conservative, if the Justice Department is not what it used to be, and if voters are barred from utilizing their right to vote with voter suppression, what is the remedy?
The remedy, you know, and that's why in the book I talk about Alabama, because it looks really daunting. I mean, as you said, what'd you call the book? Infuriating. You go through and you see how manipulative and scheming and devious so much of this is: voter ID, voter roll purges, gerrymandering. And it looks like there's no way. In Alabama, they found a way in the Doug Jones-Roy Moore battle. And there, Alabama had deployed every method of voter suppression against this black population, particularly its population in what's called the Black Belt counties, which are very poor counties in Alabama and that have sizable black populations. Every method. And it looked like Roy Moore was going to win, but civil society got in there, and they began to do what I call the heavy lifting of democracy. They figured out how to get people the birth certificates that they needed in order to get the IDs that they needed in order to vote. They figured out how to get people who had been disfranchised because of felony convictions, how they could begin to get them back into the voter rolls after they had pushed for decades for a new law, and then how to get them registered to vote. They figured out how to deal with the fact that 66 polling stations had been closed down in Alabama, which made the distance between the black community and where to vote just, it looked insurmountable. But they, like the Montgomery bus boycott, they figured out a private car system to begin to ferry people back and forth to the polls and to home so that they could be able to exercise their right to vote. In that election, John Merrill, who was the Secretary of State, thought the voter turnout rate overall would be about 25%. It turned out to be 40% statewide, but in the Black Belt counties, 45%.
Can I just say one thing, though? I'm listening to you, and you sound more optimistic than I feel listening to this, because in Alabama, you had a very, very flawed candidate. Roy Moore had so many strikes against him, and as it turned out, Doug Jones barely won. What happens when you're in a state where you don't have a Roy Moore to run against? That's the thing I'm just worried about. When I asked you about what the remedy is, you're not going to always be fortunate to have Roy Moore to run against.
You're not always going to be fortunate to have a Roy Moore. That is true. Or a Cindy Hyde Smith. Wow. And we saw that. I mean, but Mike Espy closed the gap there somewhat. And you saw that again from the mobilizing. But one of the things that is absolutely essential, and we're seeing this in several states, we're seeing several things. One is the election of secretaries of state who actually believe in democracy and not in voter suppression. And so we see three Democrats become secretaries of state in this last midterm election. That's going to make a difference. So the secretary of state position is a key position in turning this around, from people-driven initiatives like what we've seen in Michigan to massive grassroots organizing to get out the vote to get secretaries of state in place. This is the long battle. This isn't a one quick election battle. We need to understand that this is going to be a long haul battle to begin to reclaim and resurrect American democracy. But that battle is going on right now.
Carol Anderson is the hopeful chair of African American Studies at Emory University, and the author of One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol, thank you so much for this very important discussion.
Thank you so much.
Hate is all around. Find it in your heart and everywhere you can sound. On your way to school, work or church, you'll find it, it's the only room.
With an impeachment inquiry of Donald Trump currently underway, we thought what better time than now to replay this interview with former Virginia Senator John Warner. It happened only for the second time in American history. A president of the United States was impeached by the House of Representatives. And, as with Andrew Johnson in 1868, Bill Clinton was tried in the Senate. The charges were serious.
William Jefferson Clinton has undermined the integrity of his office, has brought disrepute on the presidency, has betrayed his trust as president, and has acted in a manner subversive of the rule of law and justice, to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, William Jefferson Clinton, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial, and removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
But also, as with Johnson, Clinton was acquitted. And 20 years ago, it was announced on the Senate floor by Chief Justice William Rehnquist.
On this vote, the yeas are 59, the nays are 41. Two-thirds of those senators voting, a quorum being present, not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
There were two votes, one on perjury and the other on obstruction of justice. One of the most dramatic votes, the only one that resulted in an outburst from the gallery, came from John Warner, the Republican from Virginia, during the perjury vote.
Mr. Warner, not guilty.
In the end, Clinton was acquitted on both counts. John Warner's vote was controversial. He would be up for re-election in 2 years, and he knew it would enrage conservatives, which it did. But it was part of a 30-year Senate career which, while mostly conservative, sometimes broke with his party. But it was enough to win 5 terms, including his last one in 2002, when Democrats didn't even put up a candidate against him. John Warner is here to talk about that Clinton vote and more. Senator Warner, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, what's left of the old boy is right here. Why don't you just have at him the way you want to go at it?
Well, that's the way I like him. I want you right there, Senator Warner, and I'm thrilled that you're here on The Political Junkie. You know, I remember that vote that day in 1999, that gasp in the gallery when you voted not guilty. Did you wonder if that vote was going to hurt you back home, or did you not
I had the good fortune in life to attend the University of Virginia Law School. My state is Virginia, and I then went on and I became a law clerk to a federal judge, and then an assistant United States attorney, and then, of course, I had a short period with private law firms before I came to the Senate. So the rule of law has been something that I've honored all my life, and I tried, and I think I succeeded, to eliminate any political thoughts in my mind throughout the entire trial on the impeachment indictment from the House in the Senate. And I tried to make my decisions as if I were a juror just sitting in the box, listening to the trial lawyers debate it and the witnesses giving their testimony, and then to make up my own mind independently and in absolute fairness, consistent with the law, and that's the way I cast that vote. So politics be damned. I did it the way I felt based on my long training, quite extensive training, in the law at that point in time in my career.
Now, you did find Clinton guilty on the obstruction of justice charge, but neither article of impeachment received a majority of the vote.
That is correct. I had a split vote.
Right. Did your fellow senators know that the votes to convict were not there from the beginning?
The Senate in those days was what I call a fairly jovial place, unlike today. We shared each other's lives, jokes, dined with each other, frequently visited with the wives and the family of other senators, and it was more of a tight-knit individual group pulled together by a common cause to do our job in the United States Senate. And at this impeachment proceeding, I detected that many of my colleagues and good friends, and they did it unintentionally or intentionally, just sort of withdrew within themselves as if to say, this is one tough thing I've got to do, a difficult call. I am obligated to do it by virtue of my being a member of the Senate, and I'm going to do it as best I can. And as a consequence, you'd be surprised. We didn't cluster with each other and talk and gossip about what was going on. Everybody was kind of quiet and silent for those days because it was a sort of a foreboding experience for all of us. And we pulled within our own consciences, and hopefully men and women of the Senate voted those consciences, as did I. So I don't know what the chit-chat and the chatter and so forth. The cloakrooms kind of fell silent in a way from the normal laughter and joviality, and recognizing the heavy weight of the seriousness of that decision.
I was thinking, I mean, you were in the Senate for Presidents Carter, Reagan, both Bushes, Clinton and Obama, and of course you were Navy Secretary under Richard Nixon, I know that, but which president were you closest with?
Probably, personally, Ronald Reagan. I knew him when he was governor, and I hosted some functions here in Washington with the Republican Party. I'll never forget one night we hired the Mayflower Hotel, and we had a huge banquet, had about 400 or 500 people in the cocktails, having the cocktails, and he pulled me aside and he says, I want to go check the rostrum. And I said, yeah, sure, let's go, Gov. And so we went in, and the waiters were busily finishing setting the table and pouring ice water as they were doing. And he looked at the rostrum. He said, I got to jack this thing up. So we found something to jack up the rostrum. And then in those days, in most of his speeches, he had a deck of 3x5 flip cards. And he would put those cards on the stand and quietly flip them, and his eye would catch just a little bit. He was magnificent in his ability to read a note, but always get his eyes back on the audience. You know, that's where speakers make their mistake, taking their eyes off the audience. And you got to read your audience when you're making a speech. So anyway, and then a waiter came in with a tray full of ice water, hit the rostrum, banged the thing down. Cards went all over the floor. And at the same time, they opened the doors for the cocktail people to come in. They're coming in. And here's the governor, and I'm down on our hands and knees picking up his flip cards. Then we had to get them back in order again. But I just mentioned that story because he used to come to my farm. I had a horse farm, and I used to love horses, and he loved horses. He'd call up and say, I got to get out of Washington. I just got to get out of Washington. John, if I can get on the back of one of those horses, I can forget the world. And we'd go down and ride on my farm together. One of my most cherished pictures of riding together down on the farm.
I was going to say, rather than talk about Reagan, I want to talk about more about John Warner.
Oh, the heck with him. He's an old fud.
Don't you remember him? He was in the Senate for 30 years.
I'm missing a few words. You're talking too fast. Slow down.
I'm saying that you don't remember John Warner. He's that guy who was in the Senate longer than anybody else in Virginia history, except for Harry Byrd Sr.
That's right. Harry Byrd Sr. served 32 years. I served 30.
That's right.
And I'm the second longest serving in the 200-plus years history of senators coming from Virginia to the Senate.
So how much, and then the follow-up question is, how much did you love the Senate?
I loved it very dearly. I really did. It was my home. It was my life. And my family did the best they could to get adjusted to it. Although my wife at that time, a lovely lady, I always to this day respect her. It was she finally and made a decision that she wanted to go back to Europe where she was born, and she made movies at that time. And so we peacefully had to split the sheets, but we were good friends for all the years right up until she died here not long ago. She was a good woman. Anyway.
Was that Elizabeth Taylor?
Yeah, that was Elizabeth, yeah.
Well, the reason I mentioned that is because when you were first elected in 1978, and I remember the election so well. I remember the coverage about it. It was so much about your marriage to Elizabeth Taylor and your wealth and you were a socialite, and yet when you retired after 2008, everything everybody wrote was about your intellect and your leadership and your independence. So So, I mean, I know a lot of people can change in 30 years, but the way that people saw you when you came into the Senate in 1979 was certainly different than the way people saw you when you were leaving in 2009.
Well, remember, I had a rather rocky road getting into the Senate.
I do.
We had a four-way, basically a primary with four of us running, a former retired governor, a state legislator, a very fine man, and the chairman of the Republican Party.
Richard Obenchain.
Yeah, all very able people. And Linwood Holton was the former governor. And anyway, we ran against the Attorney General, Andy Miller.
Right, the Democrat.
Whose family had been in Virginia politics for years, and he was a very able man. And we went to a convention, and I lost. There were 10,000 people that attended the convention in Richmond to pick from four candidates for the Senate, and they picked fairly and squarely Dick Obenchain. I survived three votes and then lost on the fourth to him, fair and square. And then that fateful night occurred, and I remember very well, Barry Goldwater had asked me and my wife to come up to a speech he was giving in Boston. And when he attended his speech that night, and I woke up early in the morning because I was going to address the Rotary Club of Boston at noon, and I'm looking at the Today Show, and they flashed up on the screen that a small plane carrying the Virginia candidate for Senate had crashed, and he lost his life. And Obenchain was coming into the airport down there, a small airport, in those little single-engine planes that we all flew in, and the tail hit the top of a tree, and he lost his life. We quietly went to the funeral, and once it was over, we went straight home. And then the party started its work for a couple of days, and finally they came up and asked if I would do it, and after a number of others turned it down, I hasten to say.
It's interesting. I mean, I was thinking of that day, and I remember that plane crash so well, and you got to the Senate by these tragic circumstances, and yet, almost like an afterthought, and yet you stayed there 30 years, so you must have done something right.
Well, I buckled down, did my homework, and thoroughly liked it, and I wasn't in the Senate a week until I started campaigning in every county. Not necessarily campaigning, but going into every county to introduce myself and speak to all the folks in their local, you know, Rotary clubs, civic clubs, get 10 people together, I'd give them a talk. So I enjoyed it and got to know the Senate and convinced them that I had enough of the good old Virginia country boy in me. And I ran a big farm at that time, and I remember I enjoyed the farm. I'd go back on the weekends, and I gave an annual party for the Republican Party at my farm. And my gosh, they'd come from all over the state to come up and have fried chicken and corn on the cob. And I used to have 4,000 or 5,000 people. I remember Ronald Reagan came down, spoke at my farm. You talk about presidents I knew. He said, "Sure, John, I'll come on down as long as you give me a ride on the horse." And I brought him on down.
Did Elizabeth like the Senate?
In the beginning, she did, but then the weekends, and weren't able to make the plans that she liked to do things, and I'd get home late at night. We worked hard in the Senate in those days, and the hours were pretty rough, but she grew weary of it, and she went back on the stage here in the United States and did plays in New York and Florida. I remember she opened one in Miami. And so she was on the road a lot, to going back to her profession she knew best, and she enjoyed it because sitting around the house, it wasn't much to do. So anyway, we had a good, solid understanding, and we had it was sad to part, but we stayed friends. I took her to dinner as much after we were divorced as I did before she was divorced.
You always had this reputation for working with both Democrats and Republicans, and you mentioned how much you liked Bob Dole. Who were some of the other favorite senators you worked with, especially Democrats?
I liked, oddly enough, old Ted Kennedy. I had a place up on Cape Cod then, or at least the family did, and I visited and got to know him. And I liked, you know, Fritz Hollings and John Stennis, Southern senators, that Southern group of senators, Jim Eastland. They were the great teachers in the Senate at that time. And I learned to work with the old-time Southern senators. There was quite a block of them, and they were able to stay in the Senate for as long as they wanted if they, you know, kept clean, and they did.
You know, I remember, I mean, I can't think of a time when you raised your voice in a debate or you got personal with an opponent. How do you see today's Senate? I mean, compare today's Senate to when you served.
Well, let me sort of go back a minute and characterize the Senate that I knew. And so doing, I'm not critical of any of the intervening Senates since I left. I've been out now 10 years. But it was a unique Senate in history for the following reasons. One, 75% on the average, 75% of the senators that I served with in those first years in the Senate, and really right almost to the end, 75% were veterans. Now you'll say, well, that's interesting. Well, they were veterans, and those of us that had the privilege, and I say this very earnestly, of wearing the uniform of this country, have some things in common. It doesn't make any difference if you're Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, whatever the case may be, your ethnicity, none of that counts. The most important thing is you were taught the fundamentals in the military from day one to respect your fellow soldier, sailor, airman, and so forth, because you'll never know as you go through your military career when your life depends on that individual performing correctly his or her duties so as to enable both of you to survive. That training in the military, you had a common bond. And no matter how furiously we may have fought each other on the floor, there was always that opportunity to when you sat down with your fellow service person and said, hey, remember, it's duty, honor, country. We got to solve this thing. Now let's figure out who'll give what little bit here and there and to get a compromise. And time again, that old solid military training, country first, came into play to resolve tight situations that had to be pulled apart and reconstructed and put back together again and voted on.
Do you miss the Senate, or is the Senate no longer the same institution when you were there?
No, I miss the Senate. I stay glued all night long, losing sleep, watching that thing whenever they're in a filibuster or anything else. I'm just fascinated with it.
Senator John Warner served 30 years as a Republican senator from Virginia, ending with his retirement in 2008. He cast a significant vote against convicting President Bill Clinton on the issue of perjury during the Senate impeachment trial, a vote that took place on February 12, 1999, 19 years ago this week. Senator Warner, it was an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Well, I thank you. The country is still strong. We must not lose faith in our constitutional structure of government, the ability for good men and women to come forward and serve. And while I'm not going to characterize exactly how things are going, because I'm not sure I fully understand all the ins and outs of the current administration, but the Republic stands strong, and it's a beacon of hope all across the world. We're idolized as a nation, and we've got to not necessarily hold that ground for our own benefit, but this is a one-world global society now, and the weapons that various countries have are so fearsome that no longer can we think of working in this world in isolation of other countries. We've got to learn to work together as a society for the betterment of all mankind. So I enjoyed visiting with you. I don't know that we added a single thing to the listening audience, but I enjoyed the experience to hear your voice again after these many years. You had a very distinguished career in journalism yourself. So you carry on. My bugle is no longer blowing.
I was going to say, between my career and you being that old codger you are.
Hey, man, I'm become 91 years old next week. Got that?
I got it.
I deserve a little respect from you, my buddy.
You got it. Happy birthday, Senator.
Take care.
For all their differences, Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan have at least one thing in common: their widespread popularity with Republicans. Trump, even more so than Reagan, has had near universal support from his party's members of Congress and overwhelming backing from Republican voters. Reagan suffered more defeats in Congress, even in the Senate, where his party held the majority for the first six of his 8 years in the White House. But there was something different about Reagan. He won two landslide election victories. He won support from Democratic voters. During the 8 years of his presidency and in the 30 years plus since he left the White House, he has become what many see as the standard in his party. He or she is a Reagan Republican, they would say about a candidate they liked. But there was a time when Reagan's career was filled with uncertainty. After Richard Nixon's re-election in 1972, Reagan, then the governor of California, was planning on a 1976 run. What he didn't plan on was Nixon resigning in disgrace, Gerald Ford becoming the new president, and a Republican incumbent in office in 76. Reagan challenged Ford in the primaries and came awfully close to toppling him, but he failed. And with Ford's defeat that November to Democrat Jimmy Carter, Reagan needed to decide how to make his comeback. Craig Shirley has vividly captured the Gipper's task in his book, Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976 through 1980. And we've got him on the Political Junkie. Craig, welcome back to the program.
You bet, Ken. Thank you for asking.
I'm glad you're here, and it's a great conversation. It's a great book. Describe the situation the Republican Party found itself in following Carter's election.
It was dead. The Republican Party was dead because in January of 1977, there was a national poll which asked voters under 30 of their political affiliation, and only 11% of voters under 30 identified with the Republican Party. And something like 49 out of 50 states, there was near a total Democratic rule of the governor's house and the state houses. And only one state, in Kansas, was there Republican rule of both the governorship and the state legislature. There was something like 33, 34 senators, which means the Republican senators, they couldn't mount a filibuster. The Republican Party in the House was down to, 125, 135 House members. In every description, the Republican Party is dead as a political party. It doesn't even have a coherent governing philosophy because of the few Republican senators, you've got outsiders like Jesse Helms, and you've got insiders like Jacob Javits. So there's a great division over what the Republican Party even stands for.
But you had pretty soon after the Carter presidency that the country was in bad shape heading into 1980. Describe what the country was like.
You had out-of-control inflation. You had out-of-control interest rates. You had joblessness. You had stagnation. This is a word that's never been coined before. It's a combination of hyperinflation and stagnant growth, which economic textbooks said was impossible. You either had to have one or the other, but you couldn't possibly have both. Well, in the 1970s, we had both.
Just sounds like the country was in trouble, begging almost for a Republican president in 1980, but...
Well, I wasn't sure, though, because, you know, everybody thought Ted Kennedy was the answer in polling against Jimmy Carter in 78 and 79, and in polling against Ronald Reagan, Ted Kennedy was besting everybody. So the country was hungry for strong leadership. It wasn't sure that it was hungry for strong liberal leadership or strong conservative leadership.
But it was ABC, right? Anybody but Carter.
Anybody but Carter, yes.
But it's hard to remember that Reagan himself was not a shoo-in for 1980. And I'm thinking, I remember George Bush was jogging around the country, reminding everyone that he was young and fit and Reagan was old, or that was a subtle message.
That was exactly the purpose of the jogging, was to accentuate Reagan's age at the time, which was 69.
Right, and Phil Crane said he was the future of the conservative movement while Reagan was the past, and John Connally had the support of Strom Thurmond in the very crucial state of South Carolina. So
South Carolina, yes. Yeah, Phil Crane was described by some pundits as a Reagan without the wrinkles.
So it wasn't a clear path for Reagan.
No, not at all. It was a very, very difficult path. In some ways, even more difficult than 76, because he was taken incoming from not just from Gerald Ford, as he was in 75 and 76 in the Republican establishment, but in 79 he was taken again from the Republican establishment, and then from a half dozen candidates, all who, you know, had some type of argument that they made against Ronald Reagan. You know, John Connally looked more like a president, and George Bush was more moderate, and Howard Baker was a better legislative tactician. Phil Crane was younger, and John Anderson was more liberal, more moderate. All of them seemed to have an argument based on what Ronald Reagan wasn't.
And to top it off, the first contest of 1980, Ronald Reagan lost Iowa.
Shocking. Huge, huge upset. This is not only upsetting to the political world, especially because Reagan had lived in Iowa. He was a local hero. He was Dutch Reagan on two radio stations, WOC and the other radio station there in Des Moines. He'd been a local hero there and a local celebrity all through the 1930s, and had gone back there many times to campaign for various candidates. And George Bush, of course, was an outsider, and yet it was George Bush who won the caucuses instead of Ronald Reagan. And I'll let you tell you one other thing, and then Reagan loses Iowa in a huge upset. That night on NBC News, Tom Pettit, NBC News correspondent, goes on national television and he says, "We have just witnessed the political funeral of Ronald Reagan." The New Hampshire primary now comes 1 week after the caucuses, after the Iowa caucuses. In 1980, the New Hampshire primary came 5 weeks after the Iowa caucuses. If you took the current schedule and you applied it to 1980, Bush would have won New Hampshire. Bush would have gone on to win the nomination. Reagan would have become a footnote in American history.
But he didn't lose New Hampshire. He won New Hampshire. How come?
Well, first of all, he tore up the schedule that his campaign manager had given him, which was, you know, John Sears was the manager, and his attitude was that Reagan was the front runner, and the only one who could stop Ronald Reagan from getting the nomination was Ronald Reagan. Well, Reagan was never comfortable with that sit-on-the-sidelines strategy. He liked getting out. He liked meeting people. He might like campaigning. And after losing Iowa, he planted himself in New Hampshire and pretty much stayed there for all 5 weeks of the primaries and slowly started getting back into it as the glow of Bush's Iowa win started to fade and as Bush started to make gaffes and mistakes and as Reagan started to find his strength and his stride.
And there was a great moment at a debate in Nashua.
Yes. Yeah, Reagan would have won anyway, but this kind of was the icing on the cake and increased his victory from, say, maybe 5 to 7 points to 20 points. He's in a debate. Wasn't nationally televised, but it was nationally rebroadcast. And it was supposed to be a one-on-one debate with George Bush. And at the last minute, Reagan wanted to change the format to include the other four candidates. They'd all pleaded with him in the name of fairness. And he really liked Bob Dole and Howard Baker. They really were good friends of Ronald Reagan's. And so at the last minute, he wanted the debate open, and Bush wanted the debate closed. And the only way to entice Bush into the debate was for the Reagan campaign to pay for it, which led to Reagan issuing the famous line as the other candidates are standing on stage there. He turns to the editor of the Nashua Telegraph and yells, "I'm paying for this microphone, Mr. Breen."
To make an announcement, would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off? And then, is this on? Mr. Green, did you turn that microphone?
You
off,
asked
please?
For me if you would.
I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Green.
That was one of the most amazing moments and the most dramatic moments. Yeah.
Of course, Reagan said Green instead of Breen.
I know.
But everybody kind of assumed that Reagan was so mad he might have called him something far worse.
Right. So he goes on to win the nomination and then, of course, 2 terms as president, which, of course, your book really focuses on the time in between the 76 and 80 campaign. But I can't help but think when I listen to Ronald Reagan's speeches and I listen to his optimism, I just want to play out part of his philosophy when he announced his candidacy in November of 79. I want you to listen to this piece of tape.
"I believe this nation hungers for a spiritual revival, hungers to once again see honor placed above political expediency, to see government once again the protector of our liberties, not the distributor of gifts and privilege. Government should uphold and not undermine those institutions which are custodians of the very values upon which civilization is founded: religion, education, and above all, family. A troubled and afflicted mankind looks to us, pleading for us to keep our rendezvous with destiny, that we will uphold the principles of self-reliance, self-discipline, morality, and above all, responsible liberty for every individual, that we will become that shining city on a hill. For our country's future, I pledge you my every effort. I ask for your prayers and your support. I believe that together we can keep this rendezvous with destiny.
At the time, or even in the years since, we always said the GOP was Reagan's party, and we've been seeing it, saying it, you know, well after he left office in 1989. Where do you think Reagan fits in today? And for those who say, oh, this is, you know, that was then, now it's Donald Trump's party, where is the Republican Party right now?
Reagan is gone. Reagan was 94 years old and passed away. And yet Reaganism and Reagan's philosophy is timeless. It's his words and his phrases are as timeless as those of the framers and the founders, where he talks about individual rights and liberty and privacy and dignity and all those things that are so important to we as Americans. I still know a lot of people and have met a lot of people who refer to themselves as Reagan Republicans. I don't know anybody who calls himself a Trump Republican or a Nixon Republican or a Gerald Ford Republican. There are a few people who call themselves Eisenhower Republicans. I'm not sure they know what that means, but I don't know anybody who calls himself a Trump Republican. He does not have the mystical hold on Republicans and conservatives and a lot of Democrats that Ronald Reagan did or that John Kennedy did.
I was just going to say that Reagan's effect was not only on the Republican Party, but the conservative movement as well.
Absolutely. Sure. He's still the definition of an American conservative. Reagan, I think, remains timeless. And I think that the more complicated our problems become, the more people look to him for, or look to his pronouncements for answers, because he did seem to have a lot of the answers for what afflicted American culture and society and the world.
Craig Shirley is the author of his latest book on Ronald Reagan called Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976 to 1980. Craig, congratulations on a wonderful book.
Thank you, Ken, very, very much. That means a lot. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Ben Scaldini is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. Happy Turkey, and I'll see you next week.